This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments yesterday in a case related to a Trump-era federal ban on the use of bump stocks. Bump stocks are devices that allow semi-automatic weapons to fire, in some cases up to hundreds of rounds per minute, much faster than they could otherwise. The Trump administration banned the devices on the one-year anniversary of the 2017 Las Vegas shooting, the deadliest in U.S. history. We're talking about that Supreme Court case questioning the legality of the federal ban on bump stocks, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with this current ban on these bump stock devices? Do you think they should be protected by law? If you're a firearm owner, have you ever used one of these? What are you hoping to see as this case plays out? Join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor emeritus of political science at UW-Madison and affiliate of the UW Law School. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Before we get to the bump stocks themselves, Howard, a lot of this hinges on bans on machine guns, on fully automatic firearms, mostly banned, going back as far as 1934, updated over the years. Could you give us some of the background there?
Sure. It gets a little bit complicated because the ban on machine guns was one of a number of bans on firearms, which were really of various sorts, which are really quite common throughout modern American history and even back into the colonial period. Various bans of who could own a gun or who could sell a gun or how many guns one could own or what types of gun. In the 20th century, the issue was treated as a constitutional question by the Supreme Court. And up until just a few years ago, the answer was there was no right to own military weapons. And so legislatures went around banning weapons of a type that couldn't be used for things like hunting or were not standard weapons to be used, as the phrase was. In, of course, the famous Heller case in the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms and left open whether any arms at all could be regulated. And then just last year in the Bruin case, the Supreme Court issued this extreme ruling that said regulations having to do with a right in the Bill of Rights, like the Second Amendment, which that case was about, are only constitutional if there were parallel regulations of that type in the colonial period. The reason I'm sharing all this constitutional background is that even though this case is not about the Second Amendment, it's only about the interpretation of a statute, that Second Amendment issue is lurking in the background because this statute, as you pointed out, goes back to the 1930s, and other statutes of this kind go back to the 1930s, for example, laws against sawed-off shotguns and other things of that sort. And all of those laws are called into question by recent actions of the Supreme Court on constitutional grounds. So that makes this case really interesting, because while debating the meaning of the statute, and specifically the meaning of machine gun under the statute, the justices were being forced to wrestle with the implications of their own earlier statements about gun rights.
It seems like a lot of the argument, though, hinged on whether using these bump stocks to up the rate of fire of a semi-automatic weapon made them the equivalent of a machine gun, and whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives had the right to interpret the existing laws in that way. And it seemed like there's a lot of hair splitting going on. What did you see there?
That's exactly right. And the word that comes to mind is Jesuitical. This sounded like a theological debate about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. So it's almost hard to say this with a straight face, but the argument was, is there a difference between a weapon that fires a lot of bullets when you just pull the trigger with your finger, as opposed to a weapon that fires an equal number of bullets equally quickly if you have to push it with your shoulder? That was the entirety of the dispute and the question of whether this is or is not a machine gun. Mr. Cargill and his attorneys argued that because something was involved other than just squeezing with one's finger, these are not machine guns. And Justice Barrett, for example, seemed quite sympathetic to that. Other justices, though, including, interestingly, Justices Thomas and Gorsuch, Alito, seemed quite concerned with the idea that this was a technicality used to avoid Congress's clear intent, which was, as they put it, to ban extremely lethal weapons. I think it was Justice Alito who asked the attorneys for Cargill, the guy with the gun shop, could you imagine a member of Congress passing this law who didn't think it would cover devices of this kind. So there's that whole hyper-technical linguistic issue about how to read a word in a statute and whether to take account its purpose or not, or whether to read it in some strict hyper-formal dictionary way. The second piece, which you alluded to quite correctly, is whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms exceeded their mandate in reaching that conclusion. So here the issue has to do with the fact that for a long time, ATF did not ban bump stocks. Their explanation is that the manufacturers of bump stocks originally marketed them and presented them to the ATF as devices to be useful to people who had very physical injuries, physical weaknesses, such as their hands weren't strong enough to fire an ordinary gun. Over time, the devices began to be more and more marketed and used as weapons of mass destruction, to exaggerate only slightly, and so the ATF changes position. But this becomes part of a very, very big debate going on in an enormous number of areas, in which the Roberts Court is considering how much government agencies should have authority to interpret their own mandates and determine the scope of their authority. The technical name of this is Chevron deference, and the important thing to know is that it's not just about guns, it's about environmental regulation, it's about commercial regulation and business regulation, and the whole question of how much authority executive agencies, including the ATF, have to carry out their mandates through a broad as opposed to a very, very narrow and specific interpretation of words like machine gun, that issue is on the table as well. So there's a lot wrapped up into what looks like a very technical and narrow case.
I want to dig more into that last point, and this is something that a lot of people are watching for. To what extent does a federal agency, in this case, the ATF, have to interpret to say, okay, here's this law from Congress. We think it applies to bump stocks as opposed to what we used to just call machine guns. And then the argument saying, well, if Congress meant bump stocks, they would have said bump stocks. And if they want to make it mean bump stocks, well, then Congress has to go back and do it. You, federal agency, don't have that interpretive power. Extending that across a lot of departments, that could be a pretty big deal, right?
It's an enormous deal. There are at least three cases before the Supreme Court this term that the Roberts Court could, if they want to, use to dramatically scale back the independence of executive agencies. And let's present the arguments on both sides. I think you just presented the argument for narrowing that authority. That is, if Congress wants an agency to have specific authority, they should say so. But the counter argument is most easily illustrated, I think, with things like pollutants. Congress can't possibly list every dangerous pollutant. And if they could list every dangerous pollutant, people might invent new ones. So we give the Environmental Protection Agency, traditionally, authority to identify dangerous pollutants and therefore regulate them. Similarly, Congress, the argument would be, can't possibly think of every innovation like a bump stock or a ghost gun. Those are guns that are manufactured in ways such that they're not traceable, that someone's going to come up with in order to evade gun regulations. And so it's essential, if agencies are to carry out their mandate, to carry out the policies Congress creates them to carry out, that Congress give them flexibility to decide the details, the rulemaking as opposed to the lawmaking, as it's said. Those are the two basic positions. In the problem with insisting that Congress must specify everything, one is that's essentially not what Congress is good at and would require an enormous increase in manpower, and they probably just can't do it. But of course, the other problem is that Congress is at present pretty dysfunctional and very frozen. So a ruling that says agencies only have the authority that Congress explicitly grants to them would effectively dramatically diminish the authority of agencies across the board. Up until now, for decades, the principle has been that where an agency interprets its mandate in a new way, like to cover bump stocks under machine guns, as long as that interpretation is reasonable, courts will uphold it. That's that deference I was mentioning. And the Roberts Court has signaled before that it's open to radically reconsidering that deference. And as I say, this is one of several cases this term in which that could occur.
Howard Schwaber is with us, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. He's talking to us about Garland versus Cargill. That's a case before the U.S. Supreme Court questioning whether a Trump-era ban on these bump stocks for firearms that effectively increase the rate of fire for semi-automatic weapons, whether that ban is legal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this bump stock case at the Supreme Court? Are firearms an important political issue for you? What do you want to see come out of this from the court? Do you worry that court rulings would limit the power of federal agencies to regulate firearms, pollutants, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Howard Schwaber, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court case questioning whether a Trump-era ban on bump stocks is legal. These are a firearm modifying device that can increase the rate of fire for semi-automatic weapons. The ATF under President Trump, after the huge Las Vegas tragedy, said, hey, this effectively makes them machine guns and makes them illegal under current law. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with that Trump-era ban on these bump stock devices? If the Supreme Court reverses the ban, what would you like to see happen next? Maybe action in Congress? Have you ever fired a firearm with a bump stock? What was it like? Did you notice that difference? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Howard Schwaber, mentioned earlier these were pretty technical arguments. I want to get a taste of that. Here's Justice Elena Kagan asking Justice Department lawyer Brian Fletcher about the intricacies of using a machine gun versus a semi-automatic gun fitted with a bump stock.
Would it be right to say that the pressure is, you know, on a typical machine gun where you're pulling and you're feeling, you know, continual backward pressure? And on this, you're feeling continual forward pressure of the opposite hand.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly right. I think that's exactly what the district court found.
So is the case, do you think, Howard, going to be decided narrowly on functional arguments over how a bump stock works versus a machine gun works and whether, therefore, it fits under that illegal category?
I certainly hope not. And I say that not only because of whatever feelings I might have about gun safety and gun laws, but because as a mode of statutory interpretation, that's kind of horrifying. Laws are passed for purposes, and it should not be the job, certainly in my view, and I'm not alone in this at all, of the courts to interpret laws so technically and so narrowly that they can't do the jobs for which they were passed in the first place. This just opens the door for an infinite range of ways to evade legal restrictions on any number of things by doing something that doesn't quite exactly fit the specific technical description. The difference between pulling with your trigger, with your finger, and feeling a recoil, and leaning forward with your shoulder and feeling a recoil, the idea that that could make the difference between as legal and illegal on something as lethal as a bump stock equipped semi-automatic weapon seems to me a terrible usurpation by the courts of their proper role when it comes to statutes.
Now, we have a 6-3 generally regarded conservative majority Republican appointees on the court. I've seen, Howard, a lot of observers say, hey, you got to watch Justice Amy Coney Barrett on this case in particular, potentially as a swing vote one way or another. What did you make of her line of questioning yesterday?
So Justice Barrett's line of questioning was really what we've just been describing, but taken to an even greater degree. I mean, really about, you know, is there a difference between squeezing the trigger once and holding it to create the multiple fire, or squeezing the trigger once, holding it, and then leaning forward with a shoulder to create the multiple rate of fire? Excuse me. Would it make a difference if a small plastic post were inserted in the trigger so your finger was not involved? I called this theological reasoning earlier a little bit sarcastically, obviously. But it really does come down to parsing words in a way that, first of all, no serious linguistic theorist or dictionary author would ever take seriously. I mean, the idea that words have this level of precision, and the idea that they can be given this level of precision in a situation where we're talking about legislative intent and public policy, seems to me just a really terrible indictment of just how ridiculously formalistic these justices have become. I will say, though, that it may not be the case that Barrett will be a swing vote. As I mentioned earlier, I think Justices Thomas and Alito asked some fairly probing question of the lawyer defending bump stocks that suggests their vote may not be as obvious as we think.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Julie is with us in Madison. Julie, hi.
Hi. a little bit very technical as an argument. I come at guns from the point of view of a target shooter, both high-powered rifle, range. My guns are always taken apart and cleaned when I'm done using them, and then I don't put them back together again, so they're basically just parts until I'm ready to use them again. And I, no point in picking up bullets to have on hand. It's, you know, you pick those up on the way to the range. So I don't really understand what people are doing with all these assembled guns. It sort of makes no sense.
Julie, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Is part of the argument, Howard, the intent of what people would use a bump stock for and that rate of fire for, and the reasons that might be available to the public, or we'd want to exclude it to the public?
Well, first of all, kudos to Julie for practicing good gun safety. And, you know, she's exactly right. There is no target shooting or sport-related reason to want a bump stock, nor is it a hunting weapon. This is a killing weapon. And it's used by people who do keep their guns assembled because they assert that they have a need to have them readily available to shoot at people. That's a thing that we as a society have decided to allow, and that our Supreme Court and our Constitution guarantees people to be able to do. But our legislatures have attempted to put a limit on just how lethal those weapons can be. So Julie's exactly right. This entire conversation is taking place in the context of people who are saying, I want to have guns with bump stocks so that I can kill people more effectively, and claiming they may have a legitimate reason to do that, and other people saying, no, there is never a legitimate reason to kill people that effectively, and we should be allowed to ban these things.
Thanks for the call. Mike joins us now in Shell Lake. Mike, hi. What did you want to bring up?
The bump stock thing. I want to say, first of all, that I am a part-time firearms instructor as well. I wanted to read the bump stock. Anybody that knows much about these things would not have one on their rifle. The rate of fire does increase, but it's not, the rate of fire isn't, if you have any sort of trigger control or time and practice with a rifle, the increase isn't that substantial. And you know, people get them, they go out and they fire them off, or, you know, at their homes or in the range. And I wouldn't know anyone that would have one for the purpose of defending themselves. Hmm. You have less control over the weapon, and it just isn't a legitimate thing that you would use to defend yourself.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. That's getting to what you were talking about, Howard, and I've seen people make the case that the one use case is firing into a crowd where that lack of control wouldn't matter. Is this part of the argument, again, at the Supreme Court about whether these bump stocks should be legal?
Well, no one got into that specifics in detail. I have to apologize. I couldn't hear that telephone call perfectly, but I gather the caller is a firearms instructor.
Correct.
A lot of experience.
And his case was people serious about guns don't want these bump stocks,
right.
and he questioned the self-defense value of them, yeah.
Right, because they don't increase your rate of fire all that much initially, and because they make the weapon hard to control. Mm-hmm. I say initially because if you combine a bump stock with an extra-large magazine, then according to the ATF, as you said in the intro to this discussion, it's possible to fire more than 100 rounds in a minute, which is difficult to do if you have to stop and reload and fire it manually. The main point is, as the caller points out, these things don't have a legitimate use for sport or hunting, and arguably even for self-defense. The one obvious application that they have is for something like a mass shooting. Or I imagine one could hypothesize a situation which is an oncoming mob and you want to fire indiscriminately. The Solicitor General, Ms. Prelogar, made an interesting comment in her brief. She called these dangerous and unusual weapons. The reason for that phrasing harkens back to those constitutional arguments we were talking about. even if you have a right to have a gun for self-defense, that doesn't necessarily mean you have the right to, let's say, an Uzi, a notoriously inaccurate weapon, whose use is primarily to spray, right? And we could make an argument that spraying bullets is not a legitimately defined self-defense goal. I think the Solicitor General was trying to suggest with that language about dangerous and unusual that bump stocks fall into the same category. And our caller, who is expert in these matters, seems to agree. And so I have to say, I think he has a very good argument. The problem is that was not the focus of the justices' debates and question. And somehow, when we talk about guns, getting to focus on the question of what's the justification for having these particular items, whatever it is that we're arguing about, and what limits can we put on just how dangerous they can be, those kind of questions seem to get lost in obscure linguistic hair splitting and, frankly, disingenuous historical arguments.
Mike, thanks for that call. Howard, in just our last half a minute or so, what kind of timeline do we expect after the Supreme Court hears an oral argument to where we're going to get a decision on this?
Oh, it depends how long it will take a majority to reach an agreement. And by convention, the court also waits until all dissenters have had their say and finished their opinions. So it could be as late as June, certainly this term, I expect a ruling. It could be as soon as late in April or middle April, or it could be as late as June, but certainly in the next few months.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Howard Schwaber, professor emeritus of political science at UW-Madison and affiliate of the UW Law School. He joined us today to look at a U.S. Supreme Court case on whether to overturn a Trump-era federal ban on bump stocks for firearms. You can keep sharing your thoughts on that issue. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org.